So many basketball games, so little time, maybe attention span. The NCAA tournament presents the fan with a panoply of choices of games to watch. Now, there's a new service called Thews that says they can help you know when to tune in according to your personalized excitement threshold. We're joined now from member station KQED in San Francisco by the founder of Thews, Warren Packard. Mr. Packard, thanks very much for being with us.
It's a pleasure to be here.
Personalized excitement threshold. Well, let's just be careful with that phrase. Tell us how Thews works, if you can.
Well, what we're doing is we're tracking every sports game and match for excitement in real time. So from the moment that from the moment that the ball is tipped off to the end of the game, we track every single play. And depending on what happens, we'll move up or down the excitement level. And we have a 0 to 100 scale. And as you mentioned, you can personalize your preferences. And so you can tell us when to contact you, depending on how high that excitement level gets. So if it exceeds an 85, we'll shoot an email or a text message or a tweet. And we'll let you know, hey, this is a great game.
Now, do you just have a lot of people in a room watching television?
That'd be the easy way out. Actually, we're leveraging technology here. So what our inputs are, the play-by-play feed that we get from other service providers who actually have people at the scorer's table or in the stands recording every single play of every single game. And it gets processed by our computers. And so we're able to do this in a completely automated fashion.
Now, President Obama, for example, seems to be rooting for Kansas. At least he's got Kansas to, you know, pick to win it all. So he's a mighty busy man. Tell us what kind of alerts he might get if he's, say, at a National Security Council meeting dealing with very important things, and you got to respect his time.
What I would suggest to President Obama is that he set his excitement threshold at 95. And so he's going to get alerts only to the most exciting games that are going on.
Mr. Packard, I'm a Chicago Cubs fan, and it occurs to me I could sign up for your service and never hear from you all season.
The great thing about excitement is it's completely independent of the record of the team. And in fact, it's interesting, the most exciting team in these leagues are typically the middle-of-the-road teams. They're the teams that play up to the level, the caliber of the great teams, and they play down to the level of the less-than-capable mm-hmm. teams. And so we're really broadening the exposure of these teams across the league, so you get more of a sense for what's going on around the country, which players are very interesting to watch. And so we know no bias.
Warren Packard, founder of the technology company Thews, thanks so much.
Thank you very much for your time.
This is NPR News. Teenagers have become as devoted to cell phones as they can be to gum snapping or Lady Gaga. They text, talk, and leap at the bleeble of any possible message from a friend, a parent, or Miley Cyrus. So we were intrigued to learn about a high school senior named Michelle Hackman, who won second place in a national science competition. She conducted a study to see what happens when a teenager is deprived of his or her phone. She joins us on a phone from John L. Miller Great Neck North High School on Long Island. Thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you so much.
And what did you, just take cell phones out of your friends' hands and start studying them?
I was basing my research off of a market research study that basically made the claim that the reason we can't separate from our phones is that we become anxious. Mm-hmm. And so I wanted to see whether, if I were to do that experimentally, if I were to take phones away from kids, if I would see that sort of jitteriness.
And?
And I actually found something a little bit different, but I think almost as intuitive. I found addictive tendencies in my subjects. They almost went through withdrawal symptoms. And the way that I like to explain that is that cell phones and other sorts of technology are very inherently stimulating. And so when you take them away, a kid becomes understimulated and almost doesn't know how to entertain himself.
How did you observe?
I used a biofeedback meter. I basically observed levels of stimulation, and I literally saw that subjects who had phones taken away from them experienced decreases in their stimulation.
Now, I have been told you're blind.
Yes.
How does that affect your feelings for cell phones or how you conducted the study?
I think that the one way that it really did play in is that I couldn't actually conduct the study myself because a lot of the readings on the biofeedback meter I couldn't take myself. Mm-hmm. And so I actually gathered a team of other students to administer the study for me. When we talk about science on a high school level, the most important thing is independence. So you've done the research yourself. But when you actually look at professional scientists, they're coming up with experiments, but then they spent most of their time writing grants, and then they hand the actual experiments off to their pretty much their grad students and their postdocs. And so scientists need to be able to work well with a team, and I'm lucky that I've had that experience.
Yeah, you won $75,000?
Yes.
Oh, mercy. Now, you just can't take that and have a whole big party, right?
No, the Intel Science Talent Search sends it straight off to college.
Yeah. So what are you going to do? What are your plans?
I'm going to go to Yale in the fall to study psychology, and I'm hoping to bring the cell phone research with me.
Well, Ms. Hackman, all sorts of good luck to you. Thanks very much.
Thank you so much.
Michelle Hackman, high school senior in Long Island. This is NPR News. This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Scott Simon. No actor may have played more important figures from the Holocaust than Sir Ben Kingsley. The former member of the Royal Shakespeare Company played Simon Wiesenthal, the survivor who searched for Nazi war criminals in the 1989 TV movie Murderers Among Us. He played Itzhak Stern, the accountant who helps a scheming businessman concoct a ploy to save the lives of Jews in 1993, Schindler's List. And he portrayed Otto Frank, the father who hides his family in a factory attic in the 2001 film Anne Frank, The Whole Story. Sir Ben Kingsley, who was born Krishna Banji in North Yorkshire, England, won the 1982 Academy Award for playing Mahatma Gandhi in Sir Richard Attenborough's film. We interviewed Sir Ben at the United States Holocaust Memorial Museum in Washington, D.C. recently. Began by asking, can plain people who are considered heroes in the history of the Holocaust ever be just another role?
I think that the role of the actor, perhaps at its simplest and its purest, is one of the tribal storyteller. And that if you were to transport me back maybe 3,000 years, I'd be sitting round a fire at night with the little tribe, reassuring them about their past, hoping that they will sleep through the night, and comforting them about their future, and try and build those bridges of empathy, particularly aspects of life that are baffling and frightening. To wear a yellow star in a film is an enormous responsibility. You are honoring ghosts, and sometimes you feel that you're guided by them.
Let us please take a look now at, I think, quite a famous scene. They're all famous in a way, but a particularly famous scene from Schindler's List.
How many?
850, give or take.
Give or take what, Stern? Give or take what? Count them. How many?
What did Gerd say about this? You just told him how many people you needed, and you're not buying them.
The list is an absolute good. The list is life. All around the edges lies the gulf, is the line that you didn't hear from that clip. That's a compressed dynamite. What a beautiful gift to me to be privileged to say those lines.
Some of Schindler's List was filmed literally in the shadow of Auschwitz, wasn't it?
Mm.
What was that like?
I visited it twice. It's a brilliantly, horribly designed place. It's all straight lines. It's regimented. There's no escape for the eye. There's no curves, no soft bits, nothing. I'm proud to say, and I'm completely baffled to say, I left feeling dead, feeling deeply resentful that I felt nothing. Mm-hmm. Because it took everything out of me. There was nothing left to feel.
I want to talk about your portrayal of Otto Frank now. Anne Frank and the Frank family, I think for hundreds of millions of people around the world, are at the heart of their understanding of the Holocaust. And your portrayal of Otto Frank is the portrayal of the, in a sense, the unlikeliest survivor of that family. Mm. Tell me how you approached it. Did you begin by reading the diary? Do you begin with the script before the diary?
It started during Schindler's List, and I had no idea that I'd be offered the beautiful opportunity to play Otto. I had a picture of Anne Frank in my coat pocket, and I would say to this picture, this beautiful girl, before takes, I'm doing this for you. A simple direct line from me to her. And I was thrilled beyond measure when Robert Dornhelm asked me to play Otto in the film because I'd already loved her.
Let's. I think we want to take a look at a scene from that film now, which is after the Frank family are rousted from the attic in Prinzengracht, I believe delivered to Westerbork.
If I may, I'd like to request that my daughters be assigned to kitchen duties.
I can do anything. I'm very handy.
No privileges for criminals of S-barracks.
May I ask of what crime we're accused?
Failure to report when ordered.
Next. Not a crime, sir.
Next.
It's not a crime, sir.
Next.
It doesn't make us criminals, sir.
Help us understand the emotions of a survivor as you had to play Otto Frank.
Well, I tried to define Anne. And in order for me to get into the role of her father, I had to appreciate the energy, the love from Anne to her dad. So I would have this mental picture, and it was Anne waiting to be picked up from school in the quadrangle, playground, whatever, courtyard, with her mates, her friends. And her father comes to collect her from school, and Anne sees him and turns to her friends and says, "See that man over there? That's my dad." And it was, "That's my dad," that realized that I was a hero to her. And I think that what astonishes me about Otto, that what allowed him to survive is, again, one simple phrase that maybe he kept in his pocket: "Listen to my child. Listen to my child." And I think that his work proliferating that voice was phenomenal.
How's playing all these roles affected you as a human being, as an actor?
I think I'm getting closer to the madman at the bonfire telling stories. I think it's just very important to embrace tragedy as a real part of our lives. David Mamet, in his book Writings in Restaurants, defined, let me slightly paraphrase and say, Western civilization. Western civilization is a civilization determined to outlaw tragedy. If you remove the interpretation of tragedy and the presentation of tragedy from the shaman who's sitting by the bonfire, you're telling the tribe nothing of real life. And it doesn't prepare us as adults. It infantilizes us. And it dodges an enormous responsibility. And all great mythology that we love and respect has included loss and tragedy, as well as great moments of salvation. It's braided in. After a performance I gave of Hamlet, I was walking across a field near Stratford-upon-Avon, and I saw a young woman on the other side of the field walking towards me, so I decided to go that way, and she moved that way. So I moved that way, and she moved that way. She was determined. And she faced me in the middle of this field, and she said, because I'd played Hamlet on stage the night before. She said, I saw Hamlet last night. How did you know about me? That's my job. I know you. I'm trying to know you. And through knowing each other and holding on to that tribal bonfire, we'll be okay.
Sir Ben Kingsley, being interviewed on stage about playing Simon Wiesenthal, Itzhak Stern, and Otto Frank at the U.S. Holocaust Memorial Museum in Washington, D.C.